This is Lee Vaughn, Veils of the Beloved and Inner Feminine. April 14th, 1990, tape 2 of 2.
But not everybody can be cured. And the only way an illness can be cured, because Sufis aren't healers. And why aren't Sufis healers? Because they don't come down. Because if you heal on the etheric level or on the physical level. And Sufis, we don't work on that level. So Sufis don't come down, so Sufis aren't healers. But anybody can be healed as long as they want the truth. And why? Because every human being has the right in this lifetime to be given a chance. And we had this extraordinary example with Donovan. Before he met Mrs. Tweedy, he had cancer in one lung. That was before he met Mrs. Tweedy. And he actually had an experience of seeing all the cancer cells in his body and telling them to go away, and they went. Because somewhere he had the opportunity to meet a teacher to go home, which was very beautiful. The Sufis, if you have the attitude, if you want the truth, then everything will be given, the circumstances will be right. And the Sufis get what they need. It must be, otherwise nothing would ever make sense. You have to get what you need. You have to have... The whole purpose of creation is the soul to go home, so the soul, the individual, must be given the best opportunity possible. It's the law. And it's like people, you know, they... You have to get that opportunity. And for this person, it was important at this time that a particular problem, psychological problem, was cleared out. So it was cleared out because he had the right attitude. I'll tell you another dream which describes exactly the same dynamic. I go with my wife to the races and bet on 2 horses. But instead of a ticket, I got a piece of wood carved with the names of the horses. I left the race course and drove off and then came to another race course and went to find out what had happened at the races. I found out that our horses had won and I was to receive £40,000. Then I found out that one of the horses was called El Haq, which is the truth in Arabic. So if you bet on the truth, you win. And of course, 4 being the number of wholeness, that shows that the psychological problems are taken care of. Individuation happens. It has to. I mean, that's why on this path, because we aim for the highest, you know, you start at the end. You start with the whole of yourself. You start with your desire for the truth, and that takes you on. And anything gets in the way of that, if you've paid for it, will be taken away. Now we have another person in our group who had, he first came when he was 17, and he had cancer in the blood, leukemia. And he used to run through the woods in London, shouting in anger, "Why me? Why me? I'm too young to die." He doesn't have it anymore. Because somewhere, he wanted the truth so it could be given. He'd have an opportunity. So if you want the beloved looks after you. It's very simple. It's the lover's relationship. And that will take care of all psychological problems. So in a way it's the... You know, and it's something which... This is probably the point when psychology and spirituality just take different paths. Because you don't work it out on the level of the psyche, because you're not interested in the psyche. You want something beyond the psyche. You want something else entirely. You're not really interested in being sorted out. You don't really care. And so, I mean, Jung said problems are never resolved, you just grow out of them. You know, they just don't matter anymore. And the energy that used to go into them goes somewhere else. So if you focus somewhere else, then, you know, it's like when you're young, when you're kids, I see it with my children, you know, you like ice cream and sweets and all that sort of stuff. And you always think, gosh, isn't it wonderful when you're grown up, you can have as much sweets as you like. And when you're grown up, you don't want it anymore. You know, you can have as much as you like, but you don't want it anymore. The focus changes, the interest changes. And so the energy that went into that isn't there anymore. And it's the same with, you know, psychological. So the psychological problems are very important because they are a focus. They are a stepping stone. They are a ladder, if you like, to make you look somewhere else. They take you to a point where then you can just go off. But you need the problems, but the ultimate aim is finally not to resolve the problems. And so the feminine, the anima, on one level she's psychological, but there's a whole other dimension to her, which is this, because God is a mystery. God is fascinating. He takes you into worlds you never knew about, you never believed possible. He changes everything. It's like, you know, you fall in love and suddenly the world changes. Everything's different. It was the same. I mean, you walk down the same street, but the street is different. The birds are singing. You didn't hear them before. But if you can do that with a human being, with a projection from the unconscious, what happens if you do it with him? You know, then things really change. And the beauty about the spiritual path is once things change, they change forever. Evolution does not go backwards. You work on yourself, you aspire, and you change things fundamentally. You actually change the very chemical composition of your body. You begin to attract finer substances to you. In some ways it's difficult, you become more sensitive, you can't go to places you used to go to. Because you become finer, you become more attuned. And you do it, you attract things to you, then suddenly life is different. Rather than you going out and you find things come to you. You just do what you need to do each day and what needs come to you. It's a totally, totally different way. Doesn't say that life becomes easier. No way. I mean, Mrs. Tweedy has one of the most difficult lives I've ever seen anybody have. She has no privacy, no personal life. You know, her health is constantly breaking down. And she has everybody's problems all the time. You know, life doesn't become easier. But it becomes more and more worthwhile somehow. Because you've changed, because you've changed the structure of your whole being. You've altered something very, very fundamental. And I think for a man, part of that mystery is the whole mystery of the feminine that takes you into this mysterious place of your soul. There was a dervish who once, or a prospective dervish who once came to a great Sufi teacher, and he said, can I be your disciple? And the man said, have you ever fallen in love? And he said, no. He said, okay, go off and fall in love. You know, have a relationship, be with a woman, fall in love with a woman, then come back. Because you've got to begin somewhere. You can't begin with this ideal of God. Or, you know, I mean, it's so remote for most people. It becomes something, you know, you either have a Christian God who's sitting on a cloud or the Buddhist nothingness. What does it really mean, the nothingness, the void? It's like Mrs. Tweedy said, she didn't like to talk about God, so she said the absolute. She used the word the absolute. Until she was giving a lecture in Scotland, and a little lady at the back said, Miss, what is an absolute? You know. What does it really mean? You know, the absolute. So you begin somewhere. But if you've fallen in love, if your heart's bleeding, you know what love is, then you can begin. You know, you begin from where you are. To me, you know, human love and the whole mystery, and the mystery of the feminine is so fascinating that, you know, it must have been put there for a purpose. You know, he knew what he was doing. But as long as you don't look for it as an end in itself, and I think the great mistake now is it's seen as an end in itself. So if the relationship appears not to work out, you move on to the next one. You don't see it as a whole, the beginning of this extraordinary process that takes you into realms of yourself you never knew about, that takes you beyond the mind, that makes you crazy, that makes you exhausted, that makes you feel wonderful. And it confronts you with reality as well, because sometimes the projection is gone and you're just living with an ordinary human being, and and that can go on for a long time, and to live with that and to go through it, and then to see the love change and deepen and the architect to come up in a different way, until someday suddenly somebody touches you on the inside of your heart that no human lover ever can. And then you're somewhere you can never fall in love again, because you've been touched somewhere else. And this is all part of his great play, his dance. We've been created, put in this dance of illusion in which there's you and me. Somewhere there is no you and me. It's a total illusion. It doesn't exist. But on this level, we have it. We have this strange dance of you and me, of meeting somebody, of not meeting somebody, of being here, of being there. And it has a purpose. It has this total mystery, this magic to unfold. I read you this lovely poem by Ibn al-Arabi about the feminine. He called her an image raising its head from the secrecy of the heart. The feminine is an image raising its head from the secrecy of the heart. And he wrote about her. This is her speaking to him. "Dearly beloved, I have called you so often and you have not heard me. I have shown myself to you so often and you have not seen me. I have made myself fragrant so often and you have not smelt me. Savorous food and you have not tasted me. Why can you not reach me through the object you touch, or breathe me through sweet perfumes? Why do you not see me? Why do you not hear me? Why? For you my delights surpass all other delights, and the pleasure I procure you surpasses all other pleasures. For you I am preferable to all other things. I am beauty, I am grace. Love me alone. Love yourself in me alone. Attach yourself to me. No one is more inward than I. Others love you for their own sakes. I love you for yourself. And you flee from me. Dearly beloved, you cannot treat me fairly. For if you approach me, it is because I have approached you. I am nearer to you than yourself, than your soul, than your breath. Who among creatures would treat you as I do? I am jealous of you over you. I want you to belong to no other, not even to yourself. Be mine. Be for me as you are in me, though you are not even aware of it. Dearly beloved, let us go towards union, and if we find the road that leads to separation, we will destroy separation. Let us go hand in hand. Let us enter the presence of truth. Let it be our judge and imprint its seal upon our union forever." Ibn al-Arabi. Ibn al-Arabi, a great Sufi. It comes from creative imagination in the Sufism of Ibn al-Arabi by Corbin. It's called Sophiology and Devotio Sympathetica. You can have a look. So I don't know if people have questions or... Yes. Yeah, it's actually very... because I did another workshop one stage later that went the next stage that amazed me even more. These are workshops I do in the collective unconscious. And one was to do with the wound, came up, was to do with the wounded earth and the fact that the pollution on the earth is the suffering of the earth that it needs in order to make, in order for the consciousness of man to change, that is also the consciousness of the earth to change. Just as if you have a personal problem that takes you deep inside yourself, often deeper than you've ever been before, and allows you to transform yourself. So the suffering of the earth is a necessary, the earth even understands that it is a necessary part of this transformation. And in fact, the last journey I had with, when this came up, was even more extraordinary, because it said something which was so simple that I was amazed that I'd never thought of it before. That basically the earth, the pollution in the earth will be healed by the earth from within itself. Just as if you are ill, you are usually ill because you have an imbalance. Now if you go into the depths of yourself and you restore the imbalance, then what really heals you is your own life energy purifies you. And many forms of healing are just to do with restoring this inner balance and allowing the life energy then to heal you. Now as much as this happens on a physical level, so will it also happen with the body of the earth, that we will not actually stop the pollution, we will not actually do anything about the pollution, but when the inner attitude of mankind, which is also the inner attitude of the world, because they are one while we are here, changes, then the life force on this planet will come directly from the source and will come purified, and then the world itself will purify itself. It said it would take about 200 years, I don't know what figures are like that mean, but it made total sense to me that the earth would actually purify itself, which I found very, very moving. But it needs the present state of conflict, the present desperate ravaging of the earth, which is almost suicidal, because inside yourself you only do something when things reach crisis point. Well, most people do anyway, you know. Well, this is what the earth also said, was that it came out in this, that anything you do is an act of prayer. And it is the act of prayer that will change things rather than what you do. And it doesn't matter what you do as long as you do it with the right attitude. If you recycle what you do, you recycle your garbage cans in the correct attitude, it is your attitude that would change the situation. There's a very famous, I think it's a Jewish thing, that when God wanted to destroy a city, but there was one holy man in the city who believed in God. And because of that one holy man, God did not destroy the city. We underestimate totally the power of prayer. And if things are done consciously, the moment you do something for the planet consciously, you are changing the consciousness of your environment and also of the planet. And it is that, as far as I understand, I mean, and this is very tentative, it is that that will affect the change. I mean, there was a lovely conference, this is Tweedy, a few years ago, went to something called a rainbow conference, and they have one of these terrible things in conferences where all the people sit at a table and discuss things, all the speakers, which are basically those who have bigger egos say more.
Yeah.
And there was some Greenpeace political person there who took over the stage, and they were only allowed 2 minutes, and he said, you know, spoke for 10, and everybody got angry. And they were all about the situation of the earth. And when it came to Mrs. Tweedy, you know, it was her turn to talk, she just said, well, look, it's his earth. If he wants to destroy it, he can destroy it. It's up to him. Everything is exactly as he wants it to be. God, sorry, beloved. She called it she. It's just for the sake of convenience. You know. According to the Sufis, if he wants to destroy something, he puts it into the wrong hands. It's quite simple. Thank you. But that's, you see, the Sufis believe in surrender. You surrender. It's his will. Doesn't mean you don't work on yourself, on your environment, whatever. You work incredibly hard, but you surrender. You say, finally, you know, if he destroys this planet, okay, we go somewhere else. It's not the first place we've been. It probably won't be the last. Doesn't mean you don't look after it. The care Mrs. Tweedy gives her garden is phenomenal. You know, you can hear the roses sort of burp from the amount of manure they get. Yes, sorry.
Oh, shall we?
I mean, that's how the unconscious works. Once an act, once an archetype activates, then things change totally. Well, things, everything is being speeded up immensely.
And I'm convinced that part of it is like, no matter
what, we get to. Yeah. I think your consciousness is more important than the mass media. But it's very important as well. Yeah, global consciousness is very important as well. Yeah. And Mrs. Tweedy often listens, sorry, she often listens to the World Service at night, and she says, you get the world news, and she says, it's like watching a chess player play chess on this board, global board. This person gets moved, this bit moved. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I tell you, we had a wonderful, last time we came, we went to New York, and it was a rainy Friday, and it was pouring with rain, and somebody had hired a hall, and five people came. And one of them was this great big black mama. Where she came from, I don't know. She was wonderful. All during the talk, she kept on saying, "Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah." she was absolutely priceless. And all right, yeah, she was wonderful. And then somebody asked exactly the same question you asked. One of the other four people. And she answered the question, and she said, in our hearts we have a map that was put there when we were in paradise. And if we suffer and we go into our heart and we have this fire burning in our heart, and if we go into our heart, we find this map. And if we open this map, this is our map for our life. And yet we find as we open it that it fits into every other map of all the other people around us and makes one big map that is the world map. And that was so beautiful. And then as she left, she said to Michael, "I just came along to see how my babies were doing." Where she came from, I don't know. She was wonderful.
It sounds like you confronted the Black Madonna.
She was absolutely priceless. Sorry. Yes.
The
mission, the soul's purpose is to return home. Yeah.
Why did
we
come here? Why don't we just stay there? That's the purpose. I mean, I'm
serious
question. I wonder why
we're
here.
Because he wanted to know himself. I mean, that is the philosophical, theological answer, because he was lonely. And he was not aware. Or the Sufis say he didn't know his own beauty. And through us, he becomes aware of his own beauty. So he created separation in order that he might see himself. If you're one, there is no perception of anything. Yeah. But if there is duality, then there can be perception. So he could perceive his own beauty. Yeah. Sorry, you want to ask something before? Oh yes, he had chemotherapy and everything, yes. Yeah. No, no, it didn't just happen. But he. Gosh. What is the difference between feminine power and masculine power? A woman should answer that, really, shouldn't I? I mean, a woman should say about the feminine power. I mean, can some women say what is, how many women says what is feminine power? I mean, the feminine power, it's the power of the goddess. It's, gosh, to put it in words. I mean, on one level, it's Kali, which is the total ability to absolutely destroy. It's because the feminine is life. Masculine is consciousness. Masculine is that incredibly bright light of consciousness on one level. But I think for a woman at times, you know, it's like that. It can be really... It's the sword of, I mean, this incredibly bright sword of consciousness that at times can be piercing and devastating. You know, it's like a glimpse of truth. And it can shatter you. I mean, it can change your life. Look at St. Paul on the road to Damascus. Bang. And your life is changed forever. That's the ultimate masculine power in that sense. It's, you know, that one glimpse that changes your life. Feminine power is... I think it's dark because it's mysterious. Because it's not consciously visible. It's much more unknowable. It's, it can be passion, the sort of... that makes somebody go off and do something, that changes a nation. The power comes from the unconscious, that feminine quality that... you don't see something and go and do it. You don't have an ideal like that, which is the masculine. You get swept by an urge, and you don't know where it goes or where it comes from. Like creativity that makes you do something and you don't know what it is. But it's the potency of life that can also destroy. It is like the tiger in the jungle. And you can't pin it down. You can't say it's this or it's that, because its very quality is that it's not this or that. It's many things, but it has, I mean, to me, the two words are primal power. And I think it's, I mean, why do we know so little about it? Because for the last 2,000 years, it was misused, you see. That was, in the ancient times in Egypt and things, this power was misused. And women dominated through it, and it became magic. Was misused altogether. And then, as a result, because that's the way things happen and the change, then men repressed it. It's also it's the power that knows how things work and uses that. It's moon magic. It's,
what?
Oh yes, it seems we're going towards that at the same time. Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of resurgence and a lot of understanding, but... Yeah.
Would you say that more than
on? That's perfectly correct.
And is it more over the source?
Yes, because the women are closer to the source than the men. It is life itself somewhere. If you see a tiger and you see the beauty of it and the power of it, and you know that it can destroy you, and you know that it's so beautiful. I mean, it's very interesting actually in the Mowgli books by Kipling. It is the tiger is the one that's out to get them. Tiger is the destroyer. And I mean, if you see them in the zoo, they are extraordinarily powerful. And this is... But we don't know very much yet about it, and we don't really know yet how to use it, and I suppose it has to do with the total redemption of the feminine, to integrate it. It has a lot to do with psychic phenomena, because it has a lot to do with the inner world and the mysteries of the inner world, and using it correctly, but with the dignity, and using it in relationship with the masculine. But maybe in 100 years' time we can answer the question better. Yes, sorry, okay. Yeah, the tiger lilies had to be cut in my dream. But this is necessary. And again, it's something the feminine in its depths does not understand why the sword came. It is a paradox, and it is to do with... I remember I once had an experience to do with an enormous serpent, and I had to cut this serpent up, and I didn't want to do it. And there was an enormous resistance to cutting the serpent up with a sword. Because the unconscious, but in the end I had to do it. It's like there's a desire for, let's just keep everything whole, the way it is, the way it always has been. The Ouroboros, the serpent eating its tail, and life goes on and on and on forever. There comes a point when you have to chop it to make it conscious. And for the feminine, that is a rape. And somewhere in the depths of the feminine does not understand why things had to be made conscious. It's like somewhere, I think, for a woman, the masculine is always a rape on a certain level, because there is not an understanding in the masculine of the wholeness of the feminine. Who would like things to remain whole, who would like this eternal rhythm to remain unchanged, because it understands the beauty and the wholeness of it. And it's this, it's like the, you know, the light pierced the darkness and the darkness understood it not. And the darkness not in the sense of something negative, but just in the unknown. And the woman holds that unknown within her as much as the man holds the known. And the mystery and the beauty of the feminine is in the unknown, because the woman does it not through conscious knowledge. You know, it's like the lovely story of the African woman with the, who walks with her newborn child on her back. And the white woman, white person comes and says, you know, but it doesn't have a nappy. You know, how do you know when it wants to go and don't get dirty? And the African woman looks at the white woman in astonishment and says, well, you know when you want to go, don't you? You know, because instinctively, the African woman who is at one with life knows when her child needs to go. And so it is never dirty. It's, you know, there is that oneness, that instinctual oneness, which is the realm of the feminine. And I think, you know, yeah, but she's the point where life and death are one, and there is no difference. And that again is in the realm, and that terrifies man. Man is terrified by the aspect of the feminine in which life and death are the same, because man is to do with consciousness, and there is a division and there is a difference. But a woman gives birth in blood, and that very paradox, and gives birth in suffering. And she, it's like women mature, especially women who have had children, they mature much more quickly than men, because they've got in contact with that elemental rhythm that is the basic rhythm of life. They feel it in their bodies. And women are older somewhere than men. They carry the ancient, you know, the mother, the goddess, is more ancient. Because it's she from which life came. These are, they're very, very deep mysteries. Yeah. Yes. So should we have some 10 minutes meditation and then have lunch? The psychological point of view, I'm going to talk this afternoon about it from a different point of view, mainly in relationship to two stories, the story of Yusuf and Zalaka and the story of Layla and Majnun, which are the two great love stories of all time. I mean, they're similar in the East to Romeo and Juliet are in the West. But first of all, I want to begin with my own favorite love story, which is a short story from The Conference of the Birds, which is written by one of our superiors. And it's a story called The Princess in Love with Her Slave. And all you have to remember is that from a Sufi point of view, the Sufi is called the slave. We are slaves of the one and servants of the many. And he, the great beloved, is called the servant of the servants, and that's his favorite title. His most special name is the servant of the servants. So this is called the princess in love with her slave. A king, whose empire stretched to the far horizons, had a daughter as beautiful as the moon. Before her loveliness, even the fairies were abashed. Her dimpled chin resembled the well of Joseph, and the locks of her hair wounded 100 hearts. Her eyebrows were twin bows, and when she loosed their arrows, the space between sang her praise. Her eyes, languorous as the narcissus, threw thorns of her eyelashes in the path of the wise. Her face was as the sun when he took the moon's virginity. The angel Gabriel couldn't tear his eyes from the pearls and rubies of her mouth. A smile of her lips dried up the water of life in the beholder, who yet begged alms from those same lips. Whoever glanced at her chin fell headlong into a spring of bubbling water. The king also had a slave, a youth so handsome that the sun grew pale and the light of the moon diminished. When he walked in the streets and the marketplace, crowds stopped to gaze at him. By chance, one day, the princess saw this slave, and in a moment her heart slipped from her hand. Reason forsook her, and love took possession. Her soul turned bitter. Withdrawing from her companions, she mused, and musing and reflecting began to burn. Then she called her 10 young maids of honor. They were excellent musicians and played on the shawms and pipes. Their voices were those of nightingales, and their singing, which tore the soul, was worthy of David. Gathering them around her, she told them about her state, saying that she was ready to sacrifice her name, her honor, and her life for the love of this youth. For when one is deep in love, one is good for nothing else. But, she said, if I tell him of my love, no doubt he will do something rash. If it becomes known that I have been intimate with a slave, both he and I will suffer. On the other hand, if he does not possess me, I shall die lamenting behind the curtain of the harem. I have read 100 books on patience, and still I am without it. What can I do? I must find a way to enjoy the love of this slender cypress, so that the desire of my body shall accord with the longing of my soul. And this must be done without his knowing. Then the sweet-voiced maid said, do not grieve. Tonight we will bring him here unknown to anyone, and even he will know nothing about it. Soon one of the young girls went in secret to the slave and asked him, as if to play with him, to bring 2 cups of wine. Into one cup she threw a drug, contriving that he should drink it. He at once fell asleep, so she was able to carry out her plan, and the youth of the silver breast remained without news of the 2 worlds. When night came, the maids of honor went softly to where he lay and put him on a litter and carried him to the princess. Then they sat him on a golden throne and placed a coronet of pearls on his head. At midnight, still a little drugged, he opened his eyes and saw a palace as fair as paradise, and around him were golden seats. The place was lighted by 10 great candles perfumed with amber, and sweet aloe wood burnt in the pans. The maidens began to sing, but in such sweet strains that reason bade farewell to the spirit and the soul to the body. Then the son of wine went round to the light of the candles. Bewildered with joy of his surroundings and dazzled by the beauty of the princess, the youth lost his wits. He was no longer really in this world, nor was he in the other. With a heart full of love and a body possessed with desire, amid these delights he fell into a state of ecstasy. His eyes were fastened on her beauty, and in his ears the sound of the reed pipes. His nostrils took in the perfume of amber, and the wine in his mouth became like liquid fire. The princess kissed him, and he shed tears of joy while she mingled hers with his. Sometimes she pressed sweet kisses on his mouth. Sometimes they were tinged with salt. Sometimes she ruffled his long hair. Sometimes she lost herself in his eyes. He possessed her. And so they passed the time until the dawn appeared in the east. When morning zephyr breathed, the young slave became sad. But they sent him to sleep again and took him back to his quarters. When he of the silver breast came to himself, without knowing why, he began to weep. One might say the thing was finished, so what was the good of crying out? He tore his clothes, pulled his hair, and put earth on his head. Those about him asked why he was doing this and what had happened. He said, it is impossible to describe what I have seen. No one else can ever see it except in a dream. For what has happened to me can never have happened to anyone before. Never was there a more astonishing mystery. Another said, wake up and tell us at least one of the hundred things that happened. What I have seen I can never forget, yet I have no idea where it happened. For one whole night I reveled with a beauty who is without equal. Who and what she is, I do not know. Only love remains, and that is all, but God knows the truth. So somewhere the soul loves one so much that it comes to one like that, in a dream which is neither of this world nor the other. And one becomes intoxicated and one doesn't know why. One falls in love and one doesn't know what with. In a way, this particular story has a very personal thing for me, that when I first was with met Mrs. Tweedy, I had a girlfriend then who I'd been with for 6 years, and I loved her very much. And we came to Mrs. Tweedy together, and then after a while, she left me, and I was heartbroken. I didn't really understand why at the time. And I was, you know, it broke my heart totally. I remember I would only see her at meditation meetings, and I would just look at her across the room, and my heart would just cry. It was very strange. And then, after about 9 months, I had a dream, and in this dream, I was with her again, and I was just so happy and in so much bliss. And I woke up and I thought, wonderful, we're going to be together again. And I told the dream to Mrs. Tweedy, and it was interesting because that was the first dream I had that she didn't interpret. And in fact, she didn't interpret my dreams after that at all. I had to learn to interpret them myself. So she didn't say anything. So I presumed that the dream was as I'd thought. It was a prophetic dream. And so I waited. And we never came back together again. And years and years later, I understood the dream. I understood that in the dream somewhere, I'd touched something within myself, which was love, which was the beloved. And the only way I could experience it, or visualize it, or understand it at that time, was of being back with somebody whom I loved and felt separated from. And so the whole drama of the lover and the beloved there was personified for me in a human relationship which was unfulfilled. And the whole drama of union and separation, which is the great Sufi drama, the great drama of the soul, the experiences of separation and nearness, and the love and the pain and the longing, were acted out as were pictured, were imaged in the relationship of the masculine and the feminine. And I think that's another whole cycle in which the Sufi uses the whole mystery of human love to personify the greater love. Because this is the ultimate love affair. And it's like Rumi says, he finds your way into, he, or you can call it she, you can call it whatever you like. The great beloved finds its way into your heart like a thief in the night. It comes when you least expect it. And that's why Sufis of all, if you read Sufi poetry, they're full of images of the lover and the beloved. And because most Sufi poets were men, they used the image of the woman to personify this great love affair. And they describe all aspects, the whole Sufi symbolism, in which all aspects of the woman, her eyebrows, the dimple on the cheek, the locks, all have a particular meaning. And as I said, for the woman, like the beloved, often veils her face, is a mystery, is unfathomable. One goes deeper and deeper into this mystery. Let the arrows fly from thy eyebrows' brow, let me die in thy arms, thy hands. That's Hafez. Last night she embraced me, My idol twined her arms around me, caught me, and pierced my ear with the ring of slavery. I told her, "For your love I'll roar and shout and riot," but she put her lips to mine and closed my mouth. Your eyes shed the blood of my heart, and then you said, "Keep it a secret." And this is the greatest, the secret love affair of the heart, which sometimes is so secret one doesn't even know it oneself. And this is why particularly you see people's relationship with Mrs. Tweedy, why it's so confusing, because it echoes this relationship of the lover and the beloved. It's like a friend in New York had a dream. She'd never heard of Mrs. Tweedy, knew nothing about Mrs. Tweedy, and had a dream in which she met this old woman on the green fields of England and fell in love with her. And when she woke up, she was in love, totally and absolutely, with this person in a dream. And what do you do about that? A while later, she actually saw Mrs. Tweedy's book in a bookstore, and suddenly, gosh, that was the figure of this person in a dream I fell in love with. And for years, each time she came to London, she'd just sit there and cry and cry and cry. And each time anybody would say anything, she'd just cry. And Mrs. Tweedy looked at her, she'd just cry. Because somewhere her heart was touched, her heart had been opened. And if you really love somebody, you don't exist. Only the person you love exists. If you love somebody for this reason or that reason, you don't really love them. But if you love them and you don't know why you love them, then you love them. And the more you love, the less you matter, the more just the person you love wants to matter. You want to please them, you want to make them happy, you want anything. And so you cease to exist. And that's the relationship with him too. There are two great love stories. One's Yusuf and Zalaka, or Joseph. Like we call him Joseph of the coat of many colors. And Zalaka. And Zalaka first saw Joseph in a dream. She first saw Yusuf in a dream. She was a princess. And from that moment when she saw him in this dream, she wanted nothing else but him. And what is very interesting is in the whole story shows how at the beginning she was deceived by the image, and yet also she needed the image. It's like, you know, one can't begin with the emptiness very easily. One needs an image, one needs something. It's like when in spiritual life one needs the illusion one's going somewhere. You know, if you say somebody at the beginning, "Look, there's nowhere to go." This is what Krishnamurti said. And, you know, he was very true, but he didn't actually show you the way to get there. He just said, "Look, there isn't anywhere to go. There's nothing to think about. Spiritual life doesn't really exist," which is perfectly true. But I think often at the beginning you need to think there's a goal somewhere. You know, you can go along this road and get there. I mean, later on you realize that that's really a joke, that's really a con. That's sort of, you know, that there's nowhere to go, there's no teacher, there's no nothing. And then, but at the beginning you need this image, and this is what it was like for Zalaka. And she said, this beautiful translation of Yusuf and Zalaka, which was written by Jami. I say it's also one of our ancestors. His form was erect like a slender tree, his nobility of bearing put even the proud cypress to shame. His hair hanging down in chain-like ringlets was enough to fetter the reason of the wisest mortal. Sun and moon bowed down before the radiance of his brow. His eyebrows were like bows, shooting the arrows of his lashes into every heart. When he smiled, his pearly teeth flashed between his ruby lips like lightning at sunset. The strength of his arms contrasted with the slenderness of his waist. God, what a vision! At length the grateful phantom vanished, but it left an ever-increasing impact on Zalakha's mind. She was beside herself with shock, but she stopped short of grasping the true significance of her experience. If only she had been aware that deeper meaning, she would have been numbered among those who have joined the path of truth. But being captivated by the outward form, she was oblivious at first to the underlying reality. All of us are like Zalakha, slaves of opinion, victim of appearances. If reality did not peep out from behind appearances, how should the sincere of heart ever reach the fashioner of appearances? When a thirsty man reaches for a jug, it is because he knows for certain that it contains liquid. But when he drowns in the limpid waves of the ocean, he no longer thinks of that weeping, unglazed jar. So one is deceived by appearances, and that's probably how it should be. You get caught in the beauty of somebody, because that beauty is an echo, that beauty is a reminder. And at first you have no idea of that. It's like... And when the inner world is echoed in the outer, and something deep within you is echoed in another human being, you get drawn into it. You get taken into it. Just like this extraordinary dance of Maya draws us into life, and that's how it should be. You know, you need first to go into life before you can go out of life. You can't, in a way, you can't offer yourself to him unless till you've completed what you have to complete here. It's like this extraordinary interview Mrs. Tweedy gave with a young man from Germany. And he came to ask her about spiritual life. And it was extraordinary because she didn't talk anything about spiritual life to him. She spoke about her life before the war, how when she had her husband, they went to a different restaurant every night and they danced till dawn, and she dyed her hair a different color every week, and she wore beautiful dresses and went mountain climbing. And she just talked about this. And she turned to the man and he said, "Yes, you too. Go out, live, have a good time, make love to your wife, drink beer, bring up your children. Live your life to the full, and then one day you'll wake up and say there must be something more to life." And the man said yes, that's how he felt. He had felt he had a lot to do in the world. So it's this, you know, one doesn't run away from the world and go into a cave and shut it down. No, that's running away. You live in it totally, absolutely. You surrender to it. You take the full experience of it. And then there comes a time when that appearance is no longer enough and you want something more. And then often through the image beckons something beyond. You don't leave the world behind. You go through the appearance to what's behind. Because this world is just a reflection. And for the Sufi, the beauty of his world, his beauty is reflected in the beauty of his world. And it's like, I always love, it makes me feel very relieved, this thing about Muhammad. Muhammad loved perfume and beautiful women and the shining of eyes in meditation, or the shining of eyes in prayer. And you know, because he creates things with such beauty that you must love it. You must get caught into that. And yet not stay in it forever. You get beckoned by something behind. The infinite shines through the finite. It is very beautiful. And this was Zalakha's experience. And she gave up everything to find this dream, to follow her dream. It's like Cecil Collins, English painter, he said, "It's difficult to live with a dream, but even more difficult to live without a dream." So we have a dream. She followed her dream. And she married the Grand Vizier of Egypt because she was told in a dream that if she went to Egypt, she would meet Zalakha. And then Yusuf, and then Yusuf came as a slave. If you remember, he was sold, his brothers sold him to slavery. And he came as a slave and was in a marketplace. And she saw him in the market, and she fell in love with him, and she bought him. But although he was her slave, he wouldn't yield to her. He was too pure. And another wealthy woman fell in love with him. But Yusuf had this wisdom, and he explained to her how this world is but a reflection of his beauty. Hidden behind the veil of mystery, his beauty was ever free of the slightest trace of imperfection. From the atoms of the world, he created a multitude of mirrors, and into each of them he cast an image of his face. Every single thing is an image of the face of God. Every little... It's like the atoms somewhere are dancing. And they dance his name, and they dance his dance, if you look. If you allow them to talk to you. To the perceptive eye, anything which appears to be beautiful is only a reflection of that countenance. Now that you have seen the reflection, make all haste for its source. For in that primordial light, the reflection is entirely eclipsed. It's like the lovely story of Rabia, when Rabia's serving maid came into the room, which was the shutters were closed, and said to Rabia, "It's a beautiful spring day outside, you should have a look." And she turned to the serving maid and said, "Why should I look upon the creation when I can look upon the Creator?" And went back into meditation. Now, there comes a time when this world is empty because one's seen something else. And then, you know, it's like the fact one doesn't give up the world. One doesn't say, "I renounce the world." You put on take a new name and put on a yellow robe and da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. It's like, if you've been shown something in color, do you look at something in black and white anymore? You don't. You're not interested. So what does he do? He gives you a glimpse of something. Sometimes when people first come to the group, they have extraordinary dreams, which they then don't have for years later, because they're shown. He tempts you. He wants you to come to him. He's very clever. He tempts you. He gives you a spiritual experience. The first time you sit in meditation, pow! And you experience something absolutely amazing. I mean, sometimes you don't experience it again for years. Because he's saying, "Look, you can have that." And he shows it to you. There's something extraordinary just waiting for you. And then you get confused, and you think it's this, and you think it's that. And if you're about to give up, he often usually tempts you again. It's very clever, you see. Like this lovely saying by Abu Sa'id, when he's made this very simple statement, "Love is God's trap." Which I think is beautiful, it's so simple. Love is God's trap. He designed love to entrap us. And the Sufis say, once you've tasted even the dregs of that wine, you want nothing else for the rest of your life. So it's very... And I think he uses human love and falling in love just for that sometimes. For the Sufi anyway. Like, taste this, taste that. You know, an ordinary human being, a woman, can become a goddess. And it's extraordinary. But you're not really allowed to get attached to it. And if you do, then he certainly takes it away. You know, because he is a very jealous lover. I mean, they say in the Old Testament, you know, he is a jealous lover. God is jealous, and it's absolutely true. He wants you for himself. And the moment you start getting too attached to somebody else or something else, you know, I mean, he will make it totally unpleasant. He will design. I mean, that's particularly for those, Mr. Tweedy always called being branded by God, those people for whom, some people he says, "I want you just for myself." And then it doesn't really allow you anything else. However much you run away, however much you try, nothing else really works, nothing else. But it's like that, once you've tasted something so extraordinary, nothing else rings true. It doesn't function. "Beware of lingering," this is Yusuf, he goes on, "beware of lingering far from that primal source, or else when the reflection fades, you'll be left in darkness. The reflection is as ephemeral as the rose's blush. If you want permanence, And if you want faithfulness, seek it there also. Why tear your soul apart over something that is here one moment and gone the next? When Baziga had been instructed in these mysteries, the wise girl rolled up the carpet of her passion for Yusuf. Even when I had no more than heard your description, my heart was consumed with the burning desire to possess you, and to that end I was ready to move heaven and earth. When I saw your face, I felt my strength leave me, and I would gladly have given up the ghost at your feet. But now that you have pierced the pearl of mystery, you have raised the veil from my desire and guided me from the moat to the sun itself. Now that my heart is open to this secret truth, that falling in love with you is a mere allegory of reality, it is better for me to cease dwelling in vain appearances. But he takes you into that first. He traps you in that first. And then he takes you beyond it. He takes you into his whole mystery. But for Zuleika, it wasn't so easy. She couldn't just give up this image in the story. She couldn't just say, it doesn't matter anymore. And so Yusuf became everything for her. And for some people, this total absorption in another person is their path to the beloved. Some people need to love somebody else totally and absolutely, and to be completely immersed in that other person. Even if it doesn't work out, even if it's despair, even if it's craziness. It's like he uses that. See, he uses anything he can, you know, whatever he can, whatever is the best and quickest way to get you to him, he uses. For some people it needs to be, you know, to love him in the beautiful shape of a woman or a man. It's like this little poem by Rumi, Sultan Saint Pickpocket, love has everyone by the ear, dragging us to God by secret ways. I never knew that God too desires us. He wants us. You know, too much spiritual life is shown as a path where you struggle up the mountain for this invisible goal at the top. Yes, it is like that. Somewhere, seen from here, it's like that. But there's another too, you know. There's another side too where the beloved, he wants us. He wants union with us. He wants to bring us to him. He's waiting for us. He's waiting. And so Zuleika became totally absorbed in this image of Yusuf. Zuleika let everything be the name of Joseph, from celery seed to aloes wood. She loved him so much, she concealed his name in many different phrases, the inner meaning known only to her. When she said, the wax is softening near the fire, she meant, my love is wanting me. Or if she said, look, the moon is up, or the willow has new leaves, or the branches are trembling, or the coriander seeds have caught fire, or the roses are opening, or the king is in a good mood today, or isn't it that lucky, or the furniture needs dusting, or the water carrier is here, or it's almost daylight, or those vegetables are perfect, or the bread needs more salt, or the clouds seem to be moving against the wind, or my head hurts, or my head aches better. Anything she praises, it's Joseph's touch she means. Any complaint, it's his being away. When she's hungry, it's for him. Thirsty, his name is a sherbet. Cold, he's a fur. This is what the friend can do when one is in such love. Sensual people use the holy names often, but they don't work for them. The miracle Jesus did by being the name of God, Zuleika felt in the name of Joseph. I think it's that last two lines that sort of says it, if you want it. The miracle Jesus did by being the name of God, Zuleika felt in the name of Joseph. Because for most people, God is too remote. The absolute is too absolute. The emptiness is too empty. They want it to be at the beginning more tangible. So In Christian terms, Christ came, somebody who was human, who spoke. And you see the same thing in Mrs. Tweedy's book, her relationship with Guruji. It was this strange relationship of total, absolute love and devotion, and yet at the same time she knew all the time it wasn't him. And it always puzzled her. It was a paradox she was continually confronted with. That she was totally absorbed in him. She found him incredibly beautiful. The light from his eyes was amazing. And yet at the same time it wasn't him. What was it? So you have the two at the same time. But one needs to be drawn into the one through the other. One needs to be drawn into the absolute through the creation. You know, you can't just sit down and say, right, I meditate on nothingness and go to the absolute, you know, 24 hours a day and then bang. I mean, maybe some people can. I think get a bit crazy. I tried it once when I first met Krishnamurti. And he said, don't do anything, just think of nothing. And I sat for a week like that. You know, I was absolutely off my nut after that. Well, the absolute is terribly absolute. And unfortunately, the quality of that is it tends to deny the human in you. If you see spiritual life in those terribly absolute terms, and it's just this, and it can be very hard, then there's a whole side of you that I think, in my experience anyway, then tends to get forgotten and repressed. You then don't actually live out you. And as far as I understand, one of the purposes of being incarnated is you bring yourself in fruition back to the Creator. You know, He made you because He wanted to experience you. But if you never live yourself out, if you never realize your potential, you can't take yourself back to Him. You can't offer that wholeness of yourself. So to me, that's the beauty of human relationships and living out the divine in human relationships, is you live out the human in yourself. Especially if you're an old monk or something like that, you know, you haven't had much experience in that. So for Zalaka, Yusuf became everything. In a way, Yusuf became the practice of the presence of God, you know, like in Brother Lawrence's book. She remembered him through Yusuf all the time. He became divine for her. And the image of him evoked things from the depths of herself that she probably didn't even know existed. And that's one of my experiences about human love, is it evokes things from inside of you. Because it comes inside of your own skin. It's close to you. You can't say it's spiritual life and it happens over there, or it happens in here, in this space inside of me, on these levels up there. You know, because it happens in the substance of your flesh. It happens in all of you. It includes everything. And it rubs you. You know, my gosh, it rubs you like this all the time. Day in, day out. And somehow it fuels the divine spark. It sort of, the human love fuels the divine love. It grows and grows and grows until then you can love him, until then he takes over somewhere. Then he becomes the dominant partner in the relationship. You begin with the image, you begin with the projection, and then slowly you fuel that with your love until the projection burns, or the projection gets taken away, or something happens to the projection. For the Sufi, human love can take one to reality. And yet at the same time it does so in this cunning thing that there comes the moment in which you realize that the human relationship is never complete. Even in the most intimate moments there are two of you, and somehow you want something more. Because somehow inside of you, you know there's something more. And the most extraordinary thing about the relationship with the Great Beloved is that there is no duality. There is nobody else. You know, that is why it is so, so intimate. Because there isn't anybody else. Because he comes from the inside. And he knows you from the inside. And he isn't anybody else but you. And nothing can beat that. You know? I mean, nothing at all. So it seems that through the human love, through the projection, there is this tension created of the desired object and the desire. And this whole tension somehow throws one continually off balance. Because, of course, if you project the beloved on somebody, you can never reach that anyway. It never works. And yet, you can't escape from it either. You can't just say it's just a projection, you know. Like these people who say it's just a projection. But of course it's a projection. Creation is a projection. Creation is his projection. He made the world projecting it out of himself. The world is his image. He fashioned it in his image. We are his projection. So you can't just cut it and say it's a projection. You have to live through it. And in my experience, somehow the tension of the two takes one into the beyond. And this is what happened for Zuleika. Yusuf would never give in to her. And so this particular dynamic of desiring something that could never be had, it could never be fulfilled. This is what eventually drove her to God. One time she sent him to prison because she got so angry with him because he wouldn't give up. And she thought that if he went to prison, then that would soften him. But actually, if you remember what happened in prison, is that then he interpreted these dreams and he became the Grand Vizier himself. Remember, if you remember the dreams about the 7 lean years and the 7 full years and the 7 lean years. And then the Pharaoh, he interpreted these dreams for the Pharaoh and they were correct. And then he became the Grand Vizier and Zuleika's husband died. And she then gave everything away to anybody who told her anything about Yusuf. So then she had nothing. And she sat on the roadside just waiting for news of Yusuf. And he had become very grand by then. Still very pure, but he'd become very grand. And she had nothing, absolutely nothing. And then she really suffered from the pain of separation. And then it becomes desperate. And it becomes impossible. And it will never work. And I think that happens to everybody on the path. There comes the point where the separation becomes unbearable. You want this something that is impossible, that is limitless, that is divine, that is not yours in any right at all. I mean, you want the impossible. You want the unobtainable. And you know logically it doesn't work. And this is the, you know, I think one of the most difficult stages. And you know that everything you'd thought before doesn't really make sense. And all the goals and all the idea of spiritual life being stages and here and you getting somewhere doesn't exist either, because it's just, for the Sufi it just becomes this longing, this desire, this burning, something, for something, which doesn't really exist, which isn't outside of you, which you certainly can't get hold of and you can't buy in the marketplace either, so what on earth do? And you cry and you cry and you cry. And then sometimes you think you made a big mistake and spiritual life doesn't really exist anyway. But you can't go back by this time because at this stage you've burnt all your boats. There's nowhere to go back to anymore. You know, ordinary life and ordinary values don't exist anymore, but you can't go on. And this is in all the times, the moment when then, in that moment of total, total despair. Like Rumi says, I will cry to thee and cry to thee and cry to thee until the milk of thy kindness boils up. And then in that moment, and he reaches out his hand and takes you to him. Because you can never go there on your own. You can't attain anything. You know, you can't. But then in that moment of utter despair, then he can reach out his hand. And always he takes you up the last step. It has to be that way. And you have to have reached this point of total despair. Otherwise you think you can do something. And if you think you can do something, there's still an I there. It's like in the Rumi's story of the man knocking on the door, and the person says, who's there? And he says, me. And he says, well, go away then. And the person goes off and wanders in the desert for a number of years and then comes back and knocks on the door. And the person says, who's there? And the person says, you. And then, of course, the door's open. The moment you, when you still think you can do something spiritually, there is a division. There is you. There is the ego. But when you have reached that point where you can do nothing anymore yourself, that point of total despair, then you make a space in your heart for him to come in. You have to be empty before he can come in. We have free will, you see. He made it like that. And he can't come in unless you open the door and get out of the way. Very simple. So as long as you like a thought that she could get him, she didn't get him. But when she'd given up everything, and she said, how much longer must I remain cut off from the beloved? She would cry. But finally, when he didn't notice her, she broke the image she had carried in her heart, and thus realized what was underneath. And you have to break the image of everything. They even have it in Buddhism. If you meet Buddha in the road, kill him. Everything has to go. And then they were together. And she said to him, because what happened when she said that and she broke the image, then she called out to God as he passed by. She'd wait at the roadside if he passed by in his retinue. And she called out, O pure being who made the king a lowly slave and crowned a slave with the royal crown. These words reached Yusuf's ears and he was filled with reverence. And turning to his chamberlain, he asked, who is that woman? Her glorification of God has taken my breath away. Let her be brought to my quarters so I may speak to her personally. He didn't know who she was, because she wasn't. And it's like when Miss Tweedy had a dream when she was with Guruji and she saw herself in a mirror, very, very thin and the hair in disorder falling out. And Guruji's comment was, good, thinner and thinner until nothing will remain. Everything has to go. So you don't even recognize yourself anymore. And then he asked her what her name was and where she came from. And she replied, I am someone who, from the very first moment of seeing your face, chose you above all else in the world. In order to acquire you, I squandered all my wealth and dedicated myself heart and soul to loving you. In suffering for you, I cast my youth to the wind and thus fell into my present decrepitude. But now that you have embraced that other mistress, regal power, you have forgotten me completely. But of course he didn't forget her. And then they come together, and then she's totally fulfilled. So in a way, first she began with an image and then got so totally absorbed in it, she loved it totally, and then lost herself for it. And when she was totally nothing, then she could be taken. Then she could, he embraced her. When she was totally nothing, when she'd given up all hope of everything, everything has to go, hope, desire, everything. One can't want anything for oneself anymore. And the same is in the great story of Laila and Majnun, which is probably better known. Majnun, you know, who was a schoolmate of Laila, and they loved each other totally, and then the parents separated them. And then he went mad because he couldn't be with her anymore. And that's the madness of love. He went totally crazy. And then, to me, one of the nastiest tricks of fate in the story is his father saw how much he was in love with Laila. And so he went to Laila's father and said, look, I'm a prosperous person. What about my son marrying your daughter? And the father said, look, but he's mad. We can't have a mad son-in-law in the family. But he was only mad because they separated. And he became one who has sacrificed everything for you, consumed in the fire of love, drowned in the tears of unhappiness. My longing for you is the consolation of my heart, its wound and its healing salve. I mean, there comes a time when even once the pain of love is a comfort, because that's all one has. There's nothing else. Even the anguish, even the crying out is all that one has to do, so it's the most precious thing. Nothing else has any value. It's all one's left with, one's tear, and one's tears, and one's tears. You know, when everything else becomes miserable and empty and chaos and despair, and, or you try your best, you know, to live an ordinary life day by day and not to let people notice. And Majnun said, "Oh, who can cure my sickness? Family and home, where are they? An outcast I have become. No path leads back to them and none to my beloved. Broken are my name, my reputation, like glass smashed on a rock. Broken is the drum which once spread the good news in my ears, now hear only the drumbeat of separation." As I say again, this is for the Sufi, these are the great pair of opposites, nearness and separation. And the greater the experience of nearness, then the greater the experience of separation when you're left. And he gives you the experiences of nearness, and then the veil comes down again. And then you want it more and more and more, and you cry and you cry and you cry in the separation. And the greater the nearness, the greater the separation, and the greater the longing. So it never gets any easier. Huntress, beautiful one, whose victim I am, limping, a willing target for your arrows. I follow obediently my beloved, who owns my soul. If she says, "Get drunk," that is what I shall do. If she orders me to be mad, that is what I shall be. His father took him on a pilgrimage to the Kaaba that he might pray to Allah and be healed of his madness. But he prays that his love may grow stronger. He says, "Yes, it is I who knocks at this door today. I have sold my life for love's sake. Yes, it is I. May I also be love's slave. They tell me abandon love." It's like when Mrs. Tweedy was stood at the Guruji's door and she said, "You know, I'll tell people not to come here, not to get involved, because you betray them, because you lead them into this lane of love and there's just pain there." And that's when she stood up all night in front of his door and protested the way he was treating her. Because the road of love is, once you're on it, then you've had it, and you just have to suffer. Like another time when he said to her, "You came here to stop complaining, you came here to suffer, so suffer." "They tell me abandon love, that is the path to recovery, but I can gain strength only through love. If love dies, so shall I. My nature is love's pupil. Be my fate nothing if not love, and woe to the heart incapable of passion. I ask thee, my God, I beseech thee, in all the godliness of thy divine nature, and all the perfection of thy kingdom, let my love grow stronger. Let it endure even if I perish." Finally, Guruji's father always had tears in his eyes. Always. There was always that longing, that pain of separation, which always is be when one is has a physical body. "Let me drink from this well, let my eye never miss its light. If I am drunk with the wine of love, let me drink even more deeply. They tell me, crush the desire for Lila in your heart. But I implore thee, O my God, let it grow even stronger." Like when the Sufi says, "Give me the pain of love and not the joy of love, because it's the pain that takes you home. Without the pain, why would you bother? Why would you move? You know, if you're happy, you just sit there. But if you have pain," so he poisons your heart. It's quite simple. And love is his greatest, you know, like I said, love is God's trap. Love is his greatest power and love is his greatest poison. "Let me never demand from her as much as a single hair, even if my pain reduces me to the width of one. Let her punish and castigate me. Her wine alone shall fill my cup, and my name shall never appear without her seal. My life shall be sacrificed for her beauty. My blood shall be spilled freely for her. And though I burn for her painfully like a candle, none of my days shall ever be free of this pain. Let me love, O my God, love for love's sake, and make my love 100 times as great as it is. Such was Majnun's prayer to the Almighty. His father listened silently. What could he say? He knew now that he couldn't loosen the fetters binding this heart, couldn't find a cure for its ills. There was nothing to do but to leave Mecca and start on the trek home, where they were awaited impatiently in sorrow and fear. When they arrived, the whole family surrounded the city. My name shall never appear without her seal. My life shall be sacrificed for her beauty. My blood shall be spilled freely for her. And though I burn for her painfully like a candle, none of my days shall ever be free of this pain. Let me love, O my God, love for love's sake, and make my love 100 times as great as it is. Such was Majnun's prayer to the Almighty. His father listened silently. What could he say? He knew now that he couldn't loosen the fetters binding this heart, couldn't find a cure for its ills. There was nothing to do but to leave Mecca and start on the trek home, where they were awaited impatiently in sorrow.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.